KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
He did so many good things for us that I'm sure he's resting in peace and glory with God and the angels.
The casket of Pope Francis is lying in state for 3 days at St. Peter's Basilica. Hundreds of thousands are expected to attend.
For Wednesday, April 23rd, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. This hour, the future of autism research at the National Institutes of Health.
Also, immigration lawyers say they're seeing more clients who show up for routine court appointments landing in detention.
I had my baby with me, so I had to try to keep it together for him. But it was horrible.
And later, comedian Brett Goldstein gets serious on our latest episode of Wild Card.
I think if you look hard enough at anyone, you can love them. And I do really mean that. I don't mean that in a cheesy way.
Plus, new discoveries about the magma under Yellowstone.
Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Trump has just signed a sweeping list of executive actions targeting both higher education and K-12 schools. NPR's Janet Ujong Lee looks at a few of them.
One of the half dozen executive actions called for new accreditation pathways, taking aim at colleges and universities for having, quote, abuse their authority by imposing discriminatory diversity, equity, and inclusion-based standards. Here's White House Staff Secretary Will Scharf ahead of Trump signing the executive order.
The basic idea is to force accreditation to be focused on the merit and the actual results that these universities are providing, as opposed to how woke these universities have gotten.
Other noteworthy executive actions included revising school discipline in K-12 classrooms aimed at removing DEI principles, strengthening apprenticeship programs for industrial jobs, as well as advancing AI education in public schools. Janet Wujong Lee, NPR News.
A federal judge is giving the Trump administration a deadline to answer questions about the illegal deportation of a Maryland man. NPR's Joel Rose has the story.
Three federal courts have now told the Trump administration to facilitate the return of Kilmar Abrego Garcia. The administration has conceded that the 29-year-old was deported last month because of an administrative error, but argues it cannot bring him back because he's in the custody of El Salvador. Federal Judge Paula Zinis ordered the administration to explain what steps it's taking to seek his return, but so far she has been frustrated by more stonewalling. In a scathing order, Zinis rejected several of the Justice Department's objections and accused the administration of a, quote, willful and bad faith refusal to comply with her order. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
People across the city of Chicago gathered at the city's Roman Catholic Cathedral for a mass in honor of Pope Francis today. From member station WBEZ, Adora Namigade reports.
Glory to God in the highest.
Chicagoan Catherine Moon showed up to the mass despite struggles with her Catholic faith.
We have a real issue with people who still want to stay in the church, myself being one of them. You know, people don't. My husband calls them cafeteria Catholics. I am one.
Still, she wanted to pray for the Pope with other Catholics like Kevin Kopp.
I want to be here because I think Pope Francis was a really good leader for the church.
More than 50 Chicago area clergy and interfaith leaders also paid their respects. For NPR News, I'm Adora Namigadde in Chicago.
Even as he's been working to provide some assurance to global financial markets about the continued leadership role of the U.S., Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent is also making it clear the U.S. expects something in return. Bessent telling members of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank today, America First does not mean America alone. He says the U.S. wants deeper collaboration and mutual respect among trade partners, though. Stocks rose around the world today. The Dow was up 419 points. You're listening to NPR. A major wildfire in New Jersey, about an hour east of Philadelphia, has consumed 12,000 acres and is just 35% contained. Kenneth Burns with member station WHYY reports the blaze is expected to continue until this weekend, assuming the forecast for rain holds.
Officials say the fire grew exponentially from when it was first reported Tuesday morning. Sean LaTourette, commissioner of the Department of Environmental Protection, expects the fire to continue growing.
Ultimately, when all is said and done, a greater number of acreage affected, and this could very well end up being the largest wildfire in New Jersey in 20 years.
About 5,000 residents were evacuated at one point. They've been since allowed to return to their homes. Though one business and several vehicles were lost in the blaze, homes were saved and lives were spared. For NPR News, I'm Kenneth Burns in Chatsworth, New Jersey.
Some of the biggest scam operations in the world are being carried out in East and Southeast Asia. That's according to a new UN report, which says what it's labeled as scam compounds are proliferating in areas like Cambodia, Laos, Myanmar, and the Philippines. According to the report from the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, scammers have bilked victims out of billions of dollars through various fake pitches and schemes. The operations meanwhile continue to shift to stay ahead of enforcement efforts. Crude oil futures prices after yesterday's run-up moved sharply in the opposite direction today after sources said OPEC may be considering accelerating oil output in June. Oil down $1.99 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. Dozens of world leaders, including President Trump, will be among those attending Pope Francis's funeral on Saturday. Today, his casket was moved to lie in state at St. Peter's Basilica. For 3 days, mourners will be able to pay their respects. NPR's Ruth Sherlock was with them in St. Peter's Square.
Bells tolled and a choir sang as Pope Francis's body was carried in an open casket across St. Peter's Square. Mourners clapped as the coffin slowly processed inside the basilica where Francis will lie in state for 3 days. A long line of people formed, some holding umbrellas to shield them from the sun, waiting to go inside to see him.
Because he's our leader, he's my leader. I admire him, I think he is the vicarious of Christ.
Margarita Harvey is from El Salvador and lives in Pennsylvania. She's been waiting since just after dawn.
I know he's in heaven right now. I know his body is here, but his soul is already getting what he worked for. He did so many good things for us that I'm sure he's resting in peace and glory with God and the angels.
As we prepare to go into St. Peter's Basilica, I meet Natalia Tsarkova, an official portrait artist for the Vatican. Tsarkova says she's painted four of the last popes. We go in together.
Okay, walking inside the basilica. Gold leaf ceiling, ornate marble statues.
Hundreds of people move forward slowly up the basilica aisle towards the altar and the cupola under which Pope Francis lies. Tsarkova whispers to me that she's come to thank Francis for all that he gave to her and to the world in his life. And she says it's important as we approach his casket to pray, to help him in this moment, to help his spirit rise. We reach the front, where he lies in the simple wooden casket lined with velvet that he requested.
He looks small in some ways in his coffin. You can see it's a body of a person who's no longer there. His casket is low so that people can see him. People are coming away crying.
So emotional.
So emotional, of course.
Pope Francis had a human touch. Wearing simpler robes and his plastic watch, even as Pope, he seemed to try to keep a little of the ordinary, even in his very extraordinary job. And now, that interest and affection he showed for people is coming back to him. I walk out of St. Peter's Basilica, past the long lines of faithful, some of whom sing as they wait to say goodbye to their Pope. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Rome.
A little over a week ago, Columbia University student Mohsen Mahdawi was detained by ICE agents while going to what he thought was a naturalization interview. Lawyers say they're seeing more cases like these and are warning clients that showing up for routine court appointments could lead to detention. NPR's Jasmine Garst reports.
Earlier this month, Jessica Rodriguez Aguilar and her husband, Josue, showed up at an appointment with U.S. Immigration Services in Miami.
That felt like a relief because we had been waiting almost 3 years for this interview.
Jessica Rodriguez is a U.S. citizen. She's been married for 3 years to Josue, who is originally from Honduras. He came to the U.S. when he was 14. Back then, he requested asylum from gang violence. That was denied, and he was given a deportation order, but it was never enforced. In the years that passed, the couple got married, had a child who is now 2 years old. She got a job as a receptionist at a law office. He manages a restaurant. They started a children's party rental business on the side. Jessica filed what's known as a petition for an alien relative. That was the start of a process of getting Josue's legal status. And to do that, they had to prove they're a real family. So a few weeks ago, they went to their appointment to meet an immigration officer.
He asked us where and how we had met and when and how my husband had proposed to me. He just gave me the paperwork and he said, your case has been approved. Here are the copies.
She was relieved. She was asked to wait outside with her son. But a few minutes later, she was shocked to hear her husband was being detained. His old deportation order was being enforced 8 years later.
And I had my baby with me, so I had to try to keep it together for him. But it was horrible.
There are no hard numbers, but multiple immigration lawyers tell NPR they're seeing more and more of this. Clients showing up to what they believe are routine immigration appointments and getting detained. Valerie Crespo is the attorney for the Rodriguez family.
What has been happening recently is that every time that we go with a similar situation, the client gets detained. Every time.
Historically, there's always been a possibility that an immigrant without legal status will get arrested at an appointment. But lawyers say it didn't happen often. Priority for detention and deportation was given to criminals and people deemed dangerous to their communities. But now, the Trump administration has said deportations are a priority and that they will end what they call catch and release, the practice of not enforcing deportation orders. And with the president's promise to deport a historic number of people, detention has become the default. Attorney Crespo says it's put immigrants like Josue between a rock and a hard place.
Most of them have been here in the United States for so many years, have their family, and they need to decide in whether trying to stay together or comply with the law.
At a recent hearing where another client failed to appear, the immigration judge told her this was the 15th no-show of the day. Meanwhile, Josue Rodriguez has been transferred to a detention facility in Texas. Crespo has requested a halt to the deportation proceedings. If he does get deported, she says it could take him years to get back to his family.
And this is a person that has no criminal charges. This is a person married to a U.S. citizen with a U.S. citizen son. Like, his situation should provide him some hope.
These days, Crespo is advising clients who have deportation orders to show up for their immigration appointments. It's the law. But she's also warning them, if you go, you may very well get detained. Jasmine Garst, NPR News, New York.
This weekend, thousands will gather at the Floribama, a weathered roadhouse that straddles the Florida-Alabama state line, to see who can hurl a dead fish the furthest. It's an old and odd tradition in Pensacola, where the mullet is a kind of symbol for a landscape and a culture in flux. T.S. Strickland with WUWF in Pensacola reports.
The Interstate Mullet Toss is just around the corner. But today, at Perdido Bay Seafood, the only mullet in sight is on a T-shirt. Teresa Pitts, better known as TC, runs this place. Her family has been in the seafood business for generations.
All the time, people call, ring that phone off the hook. You guys got mullet?
These days, the answer is usually no. Mullet is a silvery, bottom-feeding fish once central to working-class life along the Gulf. Like the haircut of the same name, the mullet has long been a symbol of Southern grit.
Back in the day, I mean, the mullet were everywhere, and there weren't as many houses all over the waterway. Any Joe Schmo could go down to the water and throw a cast net and catch some mullet, fry them up right there on the beach, invite all their friends.
But these days, that's less and less the case. Gina Alvarez, a state fisheries biologist, says that over the past 5 years, the mullet harvest has fallen to its lowest level since the 1990s. And she says it's not clear why.
We need further analysis in order to really determine what is going on exactly.
She says it could be that there are fewer mullet in the water, or just fewer people fishing for them. What is clear is that mullet is no longer as central to Gulf Coast culture as it once was. Even as this iconic fish has faded from markets and menus, though, there are still plenty to go around at the mullet toss this weekend. And if you want to know what to do with them, well, you just have to ask Sherry Funden. She's been a fixture at the toss for nearly 3 decades.
Pensacola, Florida. This is not Sherry's first mullet toss.
Let's go, Sherry!
This is from a video of Funden taken a few years ago. She's 72 now, and the walls in her Pensacola home are lined with more than 20 awards, each a testament to her fish-throwing finesse. She won't be tossing this year due to a back injury. Considering her mullet-tossing technique, some might call it karma.
You break its back, you fold it over, and you throw it like a baseball.
Funden started tossing in the mid-90s. But even in all of those years competing, she's never actually eaten mullet.
I've had the opportunity. No, I'm just not a big fish person.
These days, fewer and fewer even have the opportunity to try mullet. And yet, as tastes change, the toss endures. Throwing a dead fish across the state line might seem absurd, but for many who do it, it's a reminder of a time when there were fewer borders in the sand, more boats on the water, and always enough mullet for everyone. For NPR News, I'm T.S. Strickland in Pensacola.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. The National Institutes of Health has announced a plan to include private health records in a study of the rising rates of autism spectrum disorder. The move comes just days after Robert Kennedy Jr., the Secretary of Health and Human Services, unveiled a plan to find out what causes autism. NPR science correspondent John Hamilton joins us now to discuss this all. Hi there.
Hello.
So, John, first off, what do we know about this effort?
Not a lot. We know it's called Understanding Autism Spectrum Disorder. Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, the NIH director, announced it during an internal meeting this week. And he described it as an effort to explain why autism rates have risen so much. 20 years ago, the rate was estimated about 1% of children. The most recent data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention suggests the rate is now about 3%. Though there is debate about whether the apparent increase is from better detection or broadening the definition of autism.
Interesting. So what do we know about how this initiative is going to look for an explanation?
Apparently, the idea is to create a national database of autistic people and then search for anything that might have contributed to their diagnosis. So this would involve using artificial intelligence to look at records from doctors, hospitals, insurance companies, pharmacies, even federal programs like Medicaid, Medicare, and Veterans Affairs. Then there's environmental data, which could include things like exposure to lead as a child, air pollution, even vaccines. And HHS Secretary Kennedy, who oversees the NIH, sees a link between vaccines and autism. Decades of scientific studies, though, have debunked this idea.
So here's a question. I mean, is this project even doable? Can the NIH really bring together all of these different data sources in some sort of coherent manner?
It is a big challenge. In the U.S., health and medical information is scattered across lots of different public and private entities, and those entities don't really talk to one another.
Right.
I spoke with Dr. David Mendel, a professor of psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania. He says even if the NIH got all the data in one place, it probably wouldn't lead them to a specific cause, like exposure to a drug or a toxic chemical.
The exposure is probably in utero. And one of the challenges with this data set is it looks like we're studying children after they're born. And we are going to miss probably the critical exposure period.
How are autistic people and their families, their loved ones, reacting to this? Is there concern about them being in some sort of registry?
There is. This is really sensitive information, so they worry about it somehow becoming publicly available. Also, many of the people in the autism community are pretty wary of Secretary Kennedy. Mendel says that's partly because in public, he has focused on the relatively small number of people who have severe autism and are very disabled.
Both parents and autistic people have been horrified by the language that's being used to describe autism. And the characterization of autistic people as useless and a burden to society.
Last thing, John, when is this initiative expected to begin?
The NIH director wants some version of the registry to be up and running within 6 months. That's super ambitious. And there is concern that moving too fast could result in some kind of data breach.
That's NPR's John Hamilton. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Every day, like clockwork, geysers in Yellowstone National Park erupt in a burst of volcanic activity as tourists ooh and ah at the spectacle. That's from a video of Old Faithful, one of some 500 geysers in Yellowstone. New research published in the journal Nature sheds light on what's going on under the surface. Brandon Schmant of Rice University is one of the authors of the paper, and he's here to answer all our burning questions. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What did scientists already know about the volcanic activity under Yellowstone, and what were you hoping to learn?
Well, I think what scientists know and what most people know standing there is that there's got to be a lot of heat in the subsurface, and we could naturally ask, how deep is it? How deep is that beneath me if I'm standing in Yellowstone National Park? And there was a lot of debate about that with miles of potential uncertainty.
Miles of potential uncertainty. So how do you measure something so hot that it could literally melt any measuring device that you might put down there?
Yeah, that's a good point. So we don't get to dip a thermometer down into the magma reservoir, though we'd like that. We use a technique called reflection seismology. And so it means we send a seismic wave down and we wait for it to reflect off something and we hear it come back.
So you made your own little earthquakes, to quote a Tori Amos album title?
Yep. We made our own earthquakes with a large hydraulic truck all at night on paved roadside turnouts. And thankfully, there are a lot of those to prevent traffic jams so people can watch wildlife in Yellowstone. So we would drive along to these paved roadside turnouts in the middle of the night, and the truck would lift itself up enough to sort of unload the suspension. And then it would vibrate or play this short sequence for about 40 seconds. It would shake on the pavement.
Like a jackhammer for 40 seconds?
Yeah, except it doesn't lift up and then impact.
Huh.
We're not aiming to break the pavement, and we did not break anything. That's a key point.
Glad you didn't break anything in a national park. That's important.
Yeah.
And when you heard it come back, did you clear up those miles of ambiguity?
Exactly. We learned that there is a very abrupt top or cap to that magma reservoir, and that it is about 3.8 kilometers deep.
And can you tell whether this is an active volcano that's ready to blow?
Yeah, I think we can say something about that, and that it's not, it is not a volcano that's ready to blow, but it is an active volcano. It's still a dynamic system that probably has an interesting future ahead of it, but it is not imminently threatening.
Well, beyond just putting a number on how deep the magma goes, what's the use of research like this? What does it help you understand?
Sure. Well, the conditions of the magma, if we want to think about whether a magma reservoir is going to be stable or not, or what its properties will be, we need to know how deep it is, because that controls the pressure. And pressure and temper are just key variables for understanding what magma is doing.
You are a scientist at a major university doing research in a national park. Are the federal government's cuts to university research programs and national park funding likely to impact the future of your work?
So that's very possible. Through my career, and certainly for this project, it was supported by the National Science Foundation and their geophysics program, and coordinated with the National Park Service. And they, you know, they have to give us permission, but they have to do quite a bit of work to understand, you know, what we're doing, and that it's not going to conflict with all the other public users who love Yellowstone. And so they have to take some time to figure out what we're doing and ensure that it fits within the big picture of how we value our national parks.
Brandon Schmant is a professor of earth sciences at Rice University. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
Residents of a South Texas town are voting on a drastic new measure recognizing SpaceX rocket launch site as an actual city. So how do locals feel about it?
My vote's not going to count. It's not going to matter. Starbase is going to happen, as far as I'm concerned.
The battle for Boca Chica Beach tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. In Georgia, Republicans continue to file bills that put restrictions on transgender people.
We'll look at those efforts and how Democrats are responding.
People sent us here to do great work. They did not send us here to bully people, to discriminate against people.
Now the newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Hurst. The Trump administration is shutting down data collection for a landmark federally funded study about women's health. NPR's Rob Stein has more.
The Health and Human Services Department is cutting off funding for all the centers that have been collecting data about tens of thousands of women who've been participating in the Women's Health Initiative for decades. The project has produced a series of landmark discoveries about women's health, including the risks and benefits of hormone replacement therapy for menopausal women. Scientists say the decision cuts off crucial research at a time when the nation needs to study older women and chronic disease more than ever. Rob Stein, NPR News.
At St. Peter's Basilica, people are coming to pay their respects to Pope Francis, who died Monday at the age of 88. NPR's Ruth Sherlock has more.
Thousands of people have been streaming through here, waiting for hours in the sunshine outside, coming through security, and then coming here. And you can hear this quiet murmur. They've been shuffling forward towards the casket, and then they get maybe just 2 seconds to see the deceased Pope and then move on. Per the express wishes of the Pope, he's lying in a simple wooden casket covered in velvet. He's low enough that people who've come to say their goodbyes can see him and see his face and see his hands that hold the rosary.
NPR's Ruth Sherlock. This is the first of 3 days of public viewing before Francis's funeral on Saturday. The Senate's number two Democrat, Dick Durbin of Illinois, says he isn't running for re-election in 2026. His announcement caps a more than four-decade career. Wall Street higher by the closing bell, rallying on White House comments on trade tariffs and the Fed. The Dow up 419, the Nasdaq up 407. This is NPR News. Southern California could be dealing with its worst harmful algae bloom ever, and it's killing marine wildlife up and down the coast. From member station LAist, McKenna Sievertson has more.
Sea lions, pelicans, and at least two whales from separate species have died from a neurotoxin connected to the bloom, which affects the animal's brain and nervous system. Dave Bader is with the Marine Mammal Care Center in San Pedro, which has rescued hundreds of sick and stranded animals. He says dolphins have no chance of recovery.
We'll give them the dignity of a humane end of life and one that is reduced in as much stress as possible.
This is the fourth year in a row there's been a bloom like this. And Bader says it's gotten worse in recent years because of climate change. For NPR News, I'm McKenna Sievertson in Los Angeles.
The new study estimates 111 of the world's biggest companies have caused $28 trillion in climate change, but slightly less than the sum of all goods and services produced in the U.S. last year. The study by a Dartmouth College research team found more than half the total dollar figure came from 10 fossil fuel providers, including Gazprom, Chevron, ExxonMobil, BP, Shell, and others. I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive, Progressive Commercial Auto Insurance protects the vehicles that work to keep small businesses moving forward, including protection while running errands and other tasks, at progressivecommercial.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. Tying health insurance to work for roughly 80 million low-income Americans is a popular idea among Republicans. In fact, earlier this year, Republicans introduced a bill to create a national work requirement. In the meantime, states are now reviving plans to require adults to prove they are working in order to get Medicaid. Alex Olgan reports that has some Medicaid recipients concerned.
Summer Neal needs a lot of medications. The 31-year-old has a chronic disease called lupus that causes her immune system to attack itself.
I do get sick a lot because of the lupus. Someone can have a cold and it'll turn into the flu for me or pneumonia.
Any hiccup in her Arkansas Medicaid coverage can be catastrophic. That's what happened this December when she says there was a paperwork error. Neal was picking up meds to keep her pain and swelling at bay when the pharmacist told her she no longer had insurance. The tab without coverage was over $1,000.
I about lost my Jesus, okay? Like, I love the Lord, and I about lost all of it. I was like, there is no freaking way, but in more colorful words.
She says she left empty-handed and started to spiral.
If I don't have a steroid to keep this inflammation down, the amount of pain that I am in is almost unbearable.
Neal ended up delaying her rent to cover the cost of medication. The error was eventually fixed, and Neal now has Medicaid coverage again. If Neal's illness got worse and she had to stop working as a manager at a pizza restaurant, she's worried those high bills could become normal. That's because Arkansas Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders proposed a change to how Medicaid works in the state. Now, if you're a single adult making about $20,000 a year or less, you can qualify for Medicaid. These rules would add another test. You have to show you're working.
Most Arkansans work hard to pay for their health insurance, but many of these healthy adults don't work at all and receive it for free. That is not how the system should work.
Arkansas is waiting for the federal government to approve the rule change. So are Ohio and Arizona. But several studies show that more than 90% of eligible adults on Medicaid are already working, or they're exempt from the requirement because they have disabilities or are in school or are caregiving. And 7 years ago, when Arkansas did this under the first Trump administration, many of those people lost coverage anyways because they didn't follow the complicated monthly process for reporting work. And fixing that became Trevor Hawkins' full-time job.
It was overwhelming. It was my entire day.
He's an attorney with Legal Aid of Arkansas, an organization that helps low-income people with healthcare and housing issues.
Was just on the phone trying to help folks through these procedural issues, jump through those hoops.
He also says research found it didn't lead to people working more.
And so it's a bad investment. It costs the state a lot of money to administer and does not lead to any increase in employment.
Gideon Lukens is a senior fellow at the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities.
I would say that work requirements are just another way to cut Medicaid.
The Congressional Budget Office estimates that if all states had these Medicaid work rules, it could save over $100 billion over 10 years. But that savings comes at a great cost, says Lukens, people being kicked off Medicaid.
So when you have people losing coverage, yes, you do pay less money, but you also have extreme hardship.
When Arkansas changed the Medicaid rules before, it got thrown out by a judge who said it was illegal and contradicted the purpose of Medicaid, which is to provide a safety net for low-income people. Arkansas has rewritten the rules to try and get around this ruling, but it remains to be seen whether the courts allow it this time. For NPR News, I'm Alex Olgan.
Every week, a guest draws a card from NPR's wildcard deck and answers a big question about their life. Brett Goldstein is best known for starring in and helping to create Ted Lasso and Shrinking. His newest project is an HBO stand-up special out this Saturday. It's called The Second Best Night of Your Life. He told wildcard host Rachel Martin what he loves about performing stand-up.
It's not really saying, is this funny when you try something? What you're saying is, am I insane?
Based on the reaction?
Yeah, if they laugh, it's like, oh, I'm not alone. You also think
yeah,
this.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Or sometimes, no, you are insane, but it's okay. We get it. If it doesn't work, then you go, oh, I am a very weird person. And that's a horrible feeling.
Well, for his wild card answer, Goldstein told Rachel about how empathy plays into his work.
What does age teach you about love?
I read something that Steve Martin said that he found stand-up harder as he got older because, maybe not stand-up, forgive me for misquoting, he found the comedy part harder because he had more empathy for people, so it was harder to be mean. And I guess that's where comedy was. I think if you look hard enough at anyone, you can love them. And I do really mean that. I don't mean that in a cheesy way. No, I mean it like, me at my worst, like I'm saying this, I don't, you know, want to hang out with people, but like, you know, if you're like trapped with someone, you're like, oh, this person's so boring, this person's so shit. That's on you. Like I have to ask the right question. And I'm sure there is a key to this person that if I ask the right question, I will suddenly be flooded with love for them.
Yeah, I do. No. But can I nudge on that? How did you come to that realization?
I think I've had this cycle with people. I have it where I have it often. And I try to make the cycle shorter. But I've had it on jobs or something where there's a person that I will instantly dislike. Someone I'll be like, oh, this like, whether they trigger me or, you know, something about them I find so annoying or they're so pathetic, something about them, I'm like, God, they're so needy. I don't know what it is, something. I'm like, get this person away from me. And then something will happen along the way. A couple of weeks in, I'll see something, I'll see anything. And suddenly I will fight to the death for that person. Like, I'll be like, I have so much love for them.
Are you good at telling people after you've come to that, like, that arc? Like,
what, wow, do I go?
I really thought you were in that.
No, they wouldn't. I hope they wouldn't know. I wouldn't say, I thought you were an absolute nightmare. And I was wrong. Because often they still are. And there's a certain type of person where it's like, you are still a nightmare, but I've now found a way to...
Right, that's right.
Have empathy and love you.
And they probably think the same about you.
No, come on. Be ridiculous.
You can watch that full conversation by following Wild Card with Rachel Martin on YouTube. Brett Goldstein's HBO special, The Second Best Night of Your Life, is out this Saturday.
Support for Wild Card with Rachel Martin comes from the NPR Wine Club, bringing people wines inspired by NPR shows. Whether purchasing a few bottles or joining the club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's tempting to go straight from a workout on to the next part of your day, but spending some time on your post-workout recovery can reduce your chances of getting injured and allow you to get more out of your gym session, meaning you'll hit your fitness goals faster. Life Kit producer Margaret Serino has more.
Anna Cockrell didn't think much about her workout recovery in college, but once she started to, she saw her biggest fitness improvements yet.
I can run faster, I can run farther, I can do more, but it comes with the caveat of I have to warm up better and I have to recover better.
Cockrell is a professional track and field athlete, and she's coming off of her best season to date. She won a silver medal in the 400-meter hurdles at the 2024 Paris Olympics. Cockrell shares her recovery routine, everything she does between workouts to reap the biggest benefits. First,
I think it's a very bad idea to go straight from your last rep to your car.
Whatever you do, don't skip your cool down. Scientifically, the cool down is where your body first begins its recovery. Dr. Natasha Desai is a sports medicine doctor at NYU Langone. She says that when you cool down, you're bringing your heart rate down slowly so that your body can redirect blood flow to the right places.
Because you are now not exercising and you don't need all that kind of diversion of blood flow to your muscles, and you need to redirect the blood flow to your organs and digestive system and things like that.
When you skip a cool down, Dr. Desai says you could experience post-exercise hypotension, or a big drop in blood pressure. You might feel dizzy, you're low energy. So don't go from the hardest movement of your day to sitting on the couch. Try a light walk or jog on the treadmill, for example.
So if you've got an hour to get your workout in, think about spending 10 minutes cooling down. Thinking of that as like, my workout is not complete until I cool down.
Cockrell also likes to weave in little moments of stretching during her free time.
It really can just be turning on the TV and stretching when the ads come on. Like, okay, I'm gonna sit and I'm gonna touch my toes for this whole 30 seconds. I'm gonna get on the ground and get in a lunge.
Equally important for recovering well, how you fuel. Jeremy Ford is a sports dietitian and nutritionist at the University of South Carolina. He goes by the rule of thirds.
So it would be a third of protein, a third of carbs, and a third of fruits or vegetables. By following a plate like that, it makes it very simple to cover all of your bases from a recovery perspective, but also just kind of a rule of thumb for when you eat meals in general.
But right before your workout, focus on getting in easily digestible carbs.
We want to be thinking of foods that can give our bodies energy.
Think applesauce, peanut butter, Rice Krispie treats. It might take some trial and error to find the food your body responds to best. For Cockrell, recovering well is as much a victory as the workout itself. In moments when her workouts feel bad, she likes to tell herself this.
So I could be salty that I was in the back of the pack today, but a year ago, I would have been way in the back of the pack, and today I was in striking distance. So, like, a win is a win.
Maybe the win is that you returned to the gym after some time off, or that you did a cool down for the first time. Once you accumulate enough of those small victories, the wins get bigger and bigger. For NPR News, I'm Margaret Serino.
Life Kit has even more episodes about how to get more out of your workouts. Go to npr.org/lifekit.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Each spring for the last couple years, state lawmakers across the country filed hundreds of bills to place restrictions on transgender people. And even as Republican-led states already passed laws on bathrooms, sports, medical treatment, and IDs, the bills keep coming. We're taking a look at what happened this year in Georgia, an example that shows why the legislation continues and how Democrats there responded. WABE's Sam Greenglass reports from Atlanta.
When the Georgia legislature gaveled in this year, one of the first bills filed, Senate Bill Number 1, was legislation banning transgender girls from girls' sports teams. Georgia Republicans also introduced bills to restrict puberty blockers for minors and prevent the state health plan from covering gender-affirming care. But it was the debate over another bill, prohibiting the state from covering these treatments for state prison inmates, that took a surprising turn. 4 Democrats voted yes.
Colleagues, I've struggled over this legislation. I have always been committed to ensuring the dignity, humanity, and equality of all Georgians.
Among those Democrats, Senator Elena Parent, usually a vocal opponent of these kinds of bills.
I feel like we've done more bills this session picking on transgender folks than we've done anything else. But we also need to consider the public's priorities.
Republican Senator John Albers framed Democrats' choice this way.
If you support sex change drugs and surgeries with taxpayer dollars for convicted criminals, you've lost touch with your constituents and your grip on reality.
That's the kind of language Georgia Republican strategist Brian Robinson told me is already being printed on mailers ahead of the next election.
Democrats refuse, that's the word you use, refused to stand up for taxpayers when given the choice to ban transition surgeries for prisoners, because they don't share your values, because they are out of touch. That is the message.
The Trump campaign deployed similar ads in 2024, and the topic has become a staple of GOP election messaging. In some states, legislatures controlled by Democrats have strengthened rights for transgender people, but the trend is still for more bills every year to restrict them.
Republicans are out there responding and putting in rules that Americans and Georgians support.
The American Civil Liberties Union says nearly 600 anti-LGBTQ bills have been filed in state legislatures this year, most focused on the transgender community. That's a record since the ACLU started tracking. According to Pew Research Center, in recent years, Americans have become more supportive of restrictions on transgender rights. But Chase Strangio, who runs the ACLU's LGBTQ and HIV project, says that's because Republican politicians have flooded voters with messaging that says transgender people are a threat.
I think it's incredibly misguided to look at an election aftermath and decide to turn against trans people. And I think in some ways that's what we're seeing. The whole purpose of constitutional rights is to protect against erosion of the rights of politically unpopular minorities.
In Georgia, some Democrats are debating how to handle the issue. In the Senate, a few voted with Republicans on that transgender prisoners bill. But in the House, Democrats tried a different approach. Almost the entire Democratic caucus walked out in protest. They skipped the vote, drawing criticism from Republicans like Majority Leader Chuck F. Strachan.
To see members flee the chamber because they are unwilling to actually represent their constituency and let it be known to all Georgians where they stand is incredibly disappointing.
Outside the chamber, as the bill passed, House Minority Leader Carolyn Hughley said Georgia Democrats are focused on more pressing issues like health and education.
People sent us here to do great work. They did not send us here to bully people, to discriminate against people. Many of us are descendants of those who have felt the same thing.
Republicans have pledged to bring up more votes on transgender-focused bills next year as the 2026 midterms get underway. For NPR News, I'm Sam Greenglass in Atlanta.
Coyotes, they're pesky and largely unwelcome across the Great Plains. They can harm livestock and pets, and there are a lot of them. So many so that Kansas has even legalized hunting them using night vision for 3 months of the year. But now the state is considering expanding the hunting season to the whole year. Kaylin Moore of the Kansas News Service reports.
It's around midnight in rural southwest Kansas.
David Hampton stands in a field scanning the landscape for coyotes, or coyotes as they're called in these parts. He's using a handheld night vision device and a night vision scope on his gun. This allows him to hunt in complete darkness.
My dad used to drop me off when I was 10 years old in the sticks to go deer hunting, and one thing I am not is afraid of the dark.
Hampton goes out a few yards and sets up a device that calls coyotes. It can mimic howls or prey in distress. Coyote hunting is wildly popular in the Plain States, with wide open spaces and large coyote populations. In the truck, Hampton says he enjoys the difficulty of coyote hunting compared to other species.
You're coming into a predator's world, you know, and then you're trying to bring them to you.
Kansas introduced a night hunting season for coyotes back in 2021. It lasts the first 3 months of the year. The hope was to better control exploding coyote populations and give hunters more opportunities. But coyote populations have tripled since 1980, no matter what people throw at them. As the populations have increased, hunters and ranchers are asking the state to consider expanding the night vision season to year-round. Coyotes are incredibly resilient and eat about anything available. They are the most abundant large predator in the country. Jeff Nemnick hosts a show on YouTube called The Last Stand, where he teaches people tips on coyote hunting.
Together, we aim to bring you the best predator hunting tips, tricks, and tactics, right down to the last stand.
Night vision is the newest evolution in hunting technology. Nemnick says that he has shot up to 23 coyotes in a single night hunt.
At night, there's less traffic, less people out, so the coyotes move around a lot more. So, you know, as a hunter, you can usually have a little more success because the coyotes are just naturally up running around.
Kansas is one of the top states that has an abundance of coyotes. Coyotes can cost ranchers millions of dollars across the plains. The Kansas Department of Wildlife is holding meetings around the state to gather opinions on the night season. From a rancher's perspective, like Nick Czar, coyotes are pest animals that prey on cattle from his ranch. He loses money every time a calf is killed.
The financial aspect of it is probably $750 to $1,000.
Czar would like to see the season expanded to protect livestock during the late spring when calves are born. But not everyone is fully on board. Rural residents and other hunters pushed back against the night season. Tad Kramar strongly opposed night vision hunting.
As a rural resident, I would find it very disturbing to hear loud gunshots and see bright lights throughout the night.
Some law enforcement groups have also opposed the night season over fears of people using firearms at night and the possibility of deer poaching. The majority of Kansans support night vision hunting of coyotes, according to the state's Secretary of Wildlife. But the department is weighing the pros and cons. If it approves the expansion of night hunting, like neighboring states Nebraska and Oklahoma, it could happen as soon as next year. For NPR News, I'm Kaylin Moore in Liberal, Kansas.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from RBC Wealth Management, where financial advisors work to understand individual goals and are dedicated to providing customized advice to help strengthen financial security. More at rbcwealthmanagement.com. From Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering hydrangeas, lilacs, evergreens, and more. Their full collection is at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. From Easy Cater, a business tool for food, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.